Hello, everyone. What we're going to do this evening is just to have a think about evidence from archaeology that helps us to be sure about the record of the Bible. Particularly, I'm going to take our evidence just from the land of Israel. So these are archaeological records that are found within the geographical area of Israel. So there's other archaeology we could look at from Babylon or Persia and Egypt and places like that, but actually we're going to just focus in on Israel to really just to give us some confidence about the nation of Israel, the people of Israel, and the history that's recorded in the Bible record. So let me see if I can make this work. There we are. I guess sometimes people might view the Bible with a bit of suspicion. It's often dismissed as being perhaps just myths and legends. It's story, good stories, or it's manufactured facts and fiction. That the Bible can be portrayed as that sometimes, and that sometimes is because of views that have been taken in the past that say, the things the Bible talks about never existed. There are places and people mentioned in the Bible that history and the archaeology has never found evidence of. And so people then criticize the Bible and say, well, it's not, it can't be true then. And yet, as we shall see, whilst we haven't got evidence for everything in the Bible, and that's true really of anything in history, there's only a certain amount of evidence you can find from the ground or from historical records that tells you about everything that happens in a historical sense. Yet there is lots of evidence that demonstrates that what we find in the Bible is indeed true. And some of that is also because if you go and ask, reputable historians, this is just people who look at historical documents, that they look back at historical events, and they look at all the available evidence. If you go and ask most reputable historians, they will tell you that the Bible is actually recognized as a reliable source of history in the main. It's, in terms of its factual record, most historians will tell you that, it can be recognized as a reasonably reliable history book because it matches with other history sources. So that's a good thing. And what we're going to try and do this evening is really just try to add to that the kind of physical stuff, which is the stuff you find in the ground. And that helps us then to put all that together and say, well, events in the Bible, places, people, and so on were actually are actually therefore real. And therefore it isn't a book of myth and legend. It is actually a book where history has been recorded. And we can take some trust in that. Okay. First of all, we're going to start with the Old Testament. So, for those who aren't aware, the Bible, of course, is split up into two testaments. The Old Testament, which is everything recorded before the coming of Jesus Christ, and the New Testament, which covers the gospel that comes about through the ministry of Jesus and after. So let's start with the Old Testament. So this is the Bible records the Old Testament from essentially creation, from the beginning of the creation of the world, all the way through to the coming of Jesus. There's a bit of a gap at the end. And so what we get in this period is, and the reason I'm doing this is to help us in the next phase, which is where we'll get some of these artifacts on the screen and we'll see how they slot in. So let's just pick up on the fact that you get so you can get is that working? Does if I come, there's a mouse here there somewhere. No, it's not really working, is it? You get, oh no, it is there. It's just a bit jumpy. There we are. You've got a period in yeah, it's not gonna work, is it? Let me turn that off. I'll just point instead. You get the period in Egypt. So Israel spent some time in Egypt as a people, people of Israel, and they spent some time in Egypt. They came out of Egypt. They went to the land of Canaan. There was the period of what we know as Joshua and the Judges, the establishment in the land of Canaan as the land of Israel. It then goes through the period of Judges, and we eventually get to a monarchy, which is essentially where you get a king, and the nation is ruled by a set of kings. There you see Saul, David, and Solomon listed. What's called the United Monarchy, because at that point the whole of the land was under one rulership. Then it was divided into a northern and a southern kingdom, and there's a whole load of kings in that period, some of which we'll come across in our next phase of our talk. Then unfortunately there is things that go wrong with the nation of Israel, and because of judgments from God, they become they fall into the hands of oppressors, the Assyrians in the case of the north, and the Babylonians in the case of the southern kingdom. And there is a period where there is no kingdom of Israel in the land of Israel. They are in exile, and then they return from exile. And when we get to the New Testament, we find that the Jews are still in the land of Israel, but they're not governing themselves by that point. They've become kind of governed by the Romans. So that's kind of historically a bit of a whiz through. And what we're going to try and do, I'm going to throw in some archaeological artifacts, and hopefully we'll see where they fit. We'll talk about how they fit into that. We'll try and go them in some chronological order. So the first one of these is the Menepta Stele, or Stele, as I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it particularly. This is in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. It's dated to about 1200 BC, so this is quite early on. And it describes the conquests of Canaan by the Egyptians, by Pharaoh. And so this is a record of conquests of the land of Canaan by Egypt. And in this period, that within this conquest, there is reference on this stele to a people called Israel. And as I think in writing saying that this is essentially the earliest or the oldest extra biblical evidence we have of the people of Israel as a named people, a people with a particular name that they call themselves, and it's recorded there on that. And we probably would match that up with the time of the settling in Canaan of the people of Israel in the time of Joshua and the Judges. So they would be there as a people, and clearly the Egyptians in their incursions into the land of Canaan recognize that there is a people called Israel. So that's one bit of evidence. And I bring that one to your attention mainly because it references the name of a people called Israel. So it's a source outside of the Bible, written on a bit of stone that's been kind of found, and of course it's an evidence that's not connected with this. It's a record of the Egyptians that references the people of Israel. So the people of Israel clearly therefore existed. Let's move on to something else. A little bit comes a little bit later. So this is the Mesha Stele, sometimes known as the Moabite stone. If anybody's been to the Louvre, you might have seen it for real. Or if you've been in our Christadelphian Bible exhibition, we have a replica of it, dated to about 840 BC. So this is in the period of when the people of Israel are kind of having wars with the Moabites. And this is where it's useful, probably, if you've got a Bible, to just open the second book of Kings and chapter 3. So this is where we can kind of put some of this together with the Bible record, so we can have a look at it on the page and see, well, do these things tie up? So before we read the Bible record, I'll summarize. Essentially, on the Moabite stone, you have references. This is a Moabite record. This is a record of the actions of the Moabites, who are a people that lived in the same geographical area as Israel. And it describes the god Chemosh, the Moabite god, who was called Chemosh, getting angry that Moab had allowed themselves to become subjugated, to a people called Israel. And there's a description on the stone that eventually the Moabites sort that problem out, and they are successful. And in that record, there are references to the house of Omri, and also Yahweh, the God of Israel. Okay, so now if you're in now in your Bibles, look at 2 Kings chapter 3. You'll notice that we're in a period called when the king of Jehoram is reigning over Israel in Samaria. I can't really prove it to you very quickly now, but the Jehoram is a descendant of Omri. Okay, so these are the kings of Israel that are descendants from the house of Omri. Okay, so clearly we have that element here. You'll see in verse 4, Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep master and rendered unto the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and 100,000 rams with the wool. And it came to pass when Ahab was dead that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So here we have that situation described, that Moab is under tributes to Israel. They're paying these lambs and rams and wool to Israel as part of their tribute arrangements. And then when Ahab dies, the king of Israel, then the king of Moab rebels against that, decides that he's had enough of that arrangement and wants to rebel against it. Ahab is also of the house of Omri. So we've got in the record here something that matches with what's going on in this situation. Okay. Then if you just go down a little bit to the verse 21 of this chapter. When all the Moabites heard that the kings were come up to fight against them, they gathered all they were able to put on armor and upward and stood in the border. They rose up early in the morning. The sun shone upon the water. The Moabites saw the water on the other side as red as blood. They said, "This is blood. The kings are surely slain, and they have smitten one another. Now therefore, Moab to the spoil." And when they came to the camp of Israel, the Israelites rose up and smote the Moabites, so they fled before them. But they went forward, smiting the Moabites, even in their country. Now, clearly, the record that's in the Bible seems to describe something slightly different on the outcome of this. The Moabite stone says that the Moabites sorted all this out and they had a battle and they won. Whereas the Bible record says that actually in this situation, the Moabites thought they'd won, but then hadn't. Now, the question is, which record do we trust? Do we trust this or do we trust this? Well, one thing you have to remember, of course, is that this is written by the Moabites. This is the Moabites' official record of their activities. And of course, they're always going to write down what they want to be written down in the history books. I can tell you that even today in our history books, we write down the things that we want. We teach our children in our schools the bits of history we want them to learn about. That's kind of normal for most countries. So it's clearly that the Moabites did exactly that. And you could argue the same would be true of the Bible record too. This is the Jewish historical record. They're going to record it. They're going to look at it from a slightly different perspective. I'm not going to say which record we choose, because there are things like that we have to take into account. My point really is just to say that the situation of Moab being subjugate to Israel was clearly a situation that happened at this time. So there are elements of that record that do tie up. And it is important to know that the house of Omri and Yahweh, the God of Israel, that's all present here in both records. Okay? Let's move on. Let's have a look at something else. Have a look at another stele. This isn't very big. It's only, relatively small piece of stone. But the Tel Dan stele, the actual thing exists in Jerusalem in the Israel Museum, dated to a similar time period, the one we've just looked at. This comes from the northern kingdom of Israel in the place called Dan, and it refers to conflicts between the king of Syria and two enemy nations. So on this bit of rock is described two enemy nations. They are the kings of Israel and the house of David, as in the house of Israel, the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, and the house of Judah, the southern kingdom. Now, there isn't anything that we can tie this to in the biblical record. The important thing about this bit of stone is that it refers to a house of David. And it's a proof, therefore, in the biblical narrative that there is a line of kings that are related to the person David. Therefore, David as a person must have existed, and that's been disputed historically in the past. It obviously provides evidence that there were kingdoms of Israel and there were kingdoms of Judah, but also that the house of David, the lineage of David as kings, actually was true. So I put that one up there really just to kind of again demonstrate that, you know, we can't necessarily tie it in with the Bible record directly, except that the characters that are referred to here are clearly existing in our Bible record. So, I mean, there's lots of archaeology we could refer to. I'm being selective a little bit here. Here's another one, you know, moving closer along the timeline to about 700 BC, the Siloam inscription. If anyone's been to Israel, one of the things that you would do if you went to Jerusalem, probably you might go walking through Hezekiah's tunnel. It is something that you can do today. You can go and look at it. It is there to see today. This is a tunnel that King Hezekiah dug under Jerusalem to ensure that a water supply would be available in the time of siege. And that's recorded in our Bible record. If you just come over to 2 Chronicles 32, let's go and have a look at that. The interesting thing about this Siloam inscription is that it describes the construction of the tunnel. It describes two groups of engineers meeting in the middle. I don't know whether anyone remembers stories about the meeting of the French and the English underneath the English Channel with the digging of the Channel Tunnel. It's the same kind of thing. The two groups of engineers digging from both ends kind of met in the middle, which at those times you know, if you imagine digging through rocks and meeting each other underground without much in the way of electronic devices and lasers and things to work out where you are, is pretty amazing. But and so this rock is intended to describe that meeting of these things in the middle. So 2 Chronicles 32 and verse 3. Oh, verse 1 tells us that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, is encamping against the fenced cities, you see? And so when Hezekiah sees this, verse 2, when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib was come and that he was purposed to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains which were without the city. And so they did help him. And there was gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains and the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, "Why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water?" Okay, so here we have Hezekiah deciding to stop up the fountain, so stop the water running away from the city and direct it through these tunnels into the city itself, so that in siege times, with the Assyrians on the doorstep, they would have water. And that is an archaeological thing you can go and look at today if you were so inclined to do so. That particular rock is, I think, in Istanbul, but I think there is some intention to bring it back to Israel, but I'm not sure if it's made it yet. Here's another one. If you go to the British Museum in London, you can see this on the wall in the British Museum. There's also a copy of it in our Bible exhibition. 650 BC, thereabouts. It was found above the entrance to a cave near Jerusalem. And this indicates, well, what text you can read on it indicates that this is the tomb of a steward of the king. And whilst the name isn't easy to come across, it is generally accepted that it is the tomb of a man called Shebna. So if you turned now to Isaiah 22. Verse 15. So this is again in the time of Hezekiah. Hezekiah has a man called Shebna, who's his treasurer or his scribe, somebody, a royal steward of his house. Verse 15 says, "Thus saith the Lord God of hosts, go get thee unto this treasurer, even unto Shebna, which is over the house, and say, What hast thou here, and whom hast thou here, that thou hast hewed thee out a sepulchre here, as he that heweth thee out a sepulchre on high, and that graveth an habitation for himself in a rock." And here's a criticism from God to Shebna to say, you know, why are you making yourself such a fancy tomb? Verse 17 says, "Look, behold, the Lord's going to carry you away with a mighty captivity." So he's criticized for carving himself a tomb And whilst it's not possible to see the entirety of the name on the tomb on that bit of rock, most of the letters of Shebna's name exists, which leads people to think that it could very probably be Shebna's tomb that this is describing. And so here we have a record in the Bible where we know Shebna had clearly created himself a tomb, and here might very well be the bit that would sit over the doorway of the tomb to describe it as his own. Moving on then to something called the Lachish letters. So we're in a little bit later period now. We've dealt with the time of Hezekiah and the Assyrians. We're now coming to the time of the Babylonians. So this is the next empire coming along, wanting to have their dominance over the land of Israel. And as they approached into Israel and started taking bits of Israel, you'd get the eventually towns would be taken one after another. They siege the towns and take them, and then they'd move on to the next one and so on. And so what seems to happen with these letters is that towns that knew the army was coming would kind of write to each other and say, "Well, I can see them coming," whether they had binoculars or something, but they could see smoke coming from nearby towns and so on as they were laid siege to. And these are little bits of clay pot. They're just fragments of clay pots that people would write scribbled notes on, but like you would write on a jotter pad or something, and they'd send it off to the nearest town, and they describe the advancing army of the Babylonians, and it's specifically on some of these letters. The town of Lachish is referred to as being next in line. They refer to Yahweh as the God of Israel, and they also refer to a town called Azekah. So if you just come to Jeremiah 34, Jeremiah 34 comes at this time. Jeremiah's writing at this time. In fact, Jeremiah 34, if you look at verse 1, tells us this is the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army, and all the kingdoms of the earth of his dominion, and all the people fought against Jerusalem and against all the cities thereof, saying. So this is about the time of advancing Nebuchadnezzar and Babylonian army against the towns in Israel and Judah. Come down to verse 7. We don't really need to look at too much of the detail. It says, verse 7, when the king of Babylon's army fought against Jerusalem and against all the cities of Judah that were left, and here are some named cities, against Lachish and against Azekah, for these defense cities remained of the cities of Judah. So Azekah and Lachish seem to be some of the last cities that Babylon encountered on their way to Jerusalem, and these Lachish letters were bits written by people in those towns as the Babylonians advanced upon them. And it's clearly from the record that these towns did exist and Babylon was encamping against them and was going to. And so it's a really helpful kind of way of just thinking about what the life was like in those cities as the Babylonian armies advanced. And it matches with the record we have of Jeremiah. Jeremiah, of course, being a prophet of God, it was recording at this time. Okay, let's stop with the New Testament and let's move on to, sorry, I'll stop with the Old and move on to the New Testament. I've just put this up here to give us a bit of orientation of the New Testament before we delve into the actual artifacts. We've got the gospel records, which cover the ministry of Jesus, and then following that, you get the letters that come from the Apostle Paul to various churches as they were set up. There's the book of Acts, which considers the history of the work of the apostles as they went out doing their preaching. And then there's some other letters for us to see. Acts actually would slot in there in the Bible record. So remember, we've got the ministry of Jesus followed by the Acts of the Apostles, which is the record of the preaching that's done, and then the letters of Paul. First of all, let's have a think about the Pontius Pilate inscription. Again, if you're in Jerusalem, you can go and see this for real. Dated to about 30 AD, thereabout. It's an inscription that was found in the town of Caesarea, and it bears Pilate's name, Pontius Pilate's name, and calls him the prefect of Judea. Now, before this was found, the only records that ever contained the name of Pontius Pilate were in the Bible or in the record of Josephus. Josephus being a Jewish historian, he obviously was writing at the time, and so he would write a written record. So his record tied in with the Bible. Pontius Pilate, you may remember, is the one who enabled really the death of Jesus at the time. But it was thought that maybe he didn't really exist because there was no real archaeological evidence that a man by this name actually existed. Although Josephus had written about him, there was nothing much else than that. But when this was found in Caesarea with his name emblazoned on it, it added to the weight of evidence that this man, Pontius Pilate, did actually exist. And I think that's very helpful to see. Then there's something called the Temple Balustrade inscription. This is a piece of stone, and there would have been a number of these, and they're dated a bit later. But you have to understand that in the times of Herod and the time of the New Testament, the early part of the New Testament, the temple in Jerusalem was Herod's temple. It was there, and it was a Jewish sacred place, and so only Jews were allowed into the temple. Anyone else had to stay outside of the temple, outside of the temple court. And there were these bits of stone that had a writing on that said, "Nobody else is allowed to go any further than this stone." This stone would have been mar would mark the boundary of the edge of the temple court. And only Jews would be allowed to proceed onwards. That fits with the fact that we have a Jewish temple recorded in the New Testament. It's there at the time of Jesus, without a shadow of a doubt. And it might have inspired Paul to write what he wrote in Ephesians chapter 2, where you can turn this up if you like, but I will read it anyway. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 13. Paul says to the church at Ephesus, he says, "Now in Christ Jesus, you who were sometimes were far off," so you're kind of talking about Jews and Gentiles who would have been kind of separated at one time by this kind of this religious situation, "are now made nigh," he says, "by the blood of Christ. For he is our peace, who hath made both one and hath broken down the middle wall of partition between us." Whether that's what Paul is referring to, we don't know. But the point is that there was a wall that was separating Jews and Gentiles. And Paul says that wall in Jesus Christ is now gone. And lastly, really, in our look here, we've got something called the Politarch inscription. I think this is in the British Museum, but it's not always on display, sadly. Dated a bit later. So this was found. This would have been built into a wall at what's called the Vardar Gate in Thessalonica, and this is a record. It's a list of all of the important people in the city, the civic officials of Thessalonica, and this included in this six Politarchs. I don't know if you've ever seen. You've gone into some schools sometimes. There's a list of all the head teachers over the years, and they'll get their name written down when they leave and move on. It's a bit like that, is that over time there'd be these Politarchs, these officials, and they get their name recorded in this bit of wall, and it's the term Politarch is a phrase that's used by Luke in Acts chapter 17. So if you come to Acts chapter 17 and verse 6, so there's a whole rumpus going on in Thessalonica. Paul has gone teaching in the synagogue, and it's kind of annoyed all the Jews, and they've created a bit of an uproar. And we find verse 6, "And when they found them not, they drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying out, These that have turned the world upside down are come hither also." And it says, this man's Jason has received them all, and it's all dreadfully bad. And they troubled the people and the rulers of the city when they heard these things. And that word, the rulers of the city, is this term politarch, which Luke had used. That the authorized version unfortunately just calls them a ruler, but it's a term politarch that Luke uses here. And there was a criticism that maybe Luke had got it wrong. These positions of a politarch didn't exist until this piece of stone was found, and in Thessalonica, that named these politarchs, and it used the same word that Luke has indeed recorded here in the record. So that means that Luke is using the right terminology. He's referring to the rulers of the city in the right way. As Luke should, as the scribe, as the record keeper here of what's been going on. So Luke, in his record in the Acts, has done the right thing, used the right terminology, and now we can prove that he was right all along. Okay, that's a bit of a whistle-stop tour through some archaeology that we can find, but it's really just to kind of make the point, I think, and I'm hoping we've made the point anyway, that there is no doubt that archaeology can help to prove the reality of events and people in the Bible. They did exist. They were there. What the Bible says happened did happen, and we can be sure of that. And there's more archaeology we could look at to do that. I've just been very selective this evening. And as time goes on, more and more discoveries come to light, and they continue to prove the point. They provide a bit of a snapshot into that reality. It's a bit like those Lakish letters. It just gives us a bit of a snapshot into the life of a town that knows it's going to be next on the Babylonian invasion hit list. And it kind of helps us to get a real grip of and a real understanding of the reality of the situation at the time. Clearly, those people in Lachish were really worried about it. And that's the reason why they're writing letters to each other about it. And it makes it all more real, I suggest. And so, therefore, if the point, therefore, we might come to is if the history is right, if the facts are right, if the people are right, if the events are right, if we can go from, the time of the settling of Canaan all the way through to the Acts of the Apostles, and we've seen evidence from all of that, that's quite a big chunk of the Bible. Then what about the rest of the Bible? What about all the other things the Bible tells us about? Clearly, we don't have historical evidence or archaeological evidence for everything. But if these things fit, then what about the rest of it? What about all the things that God has promised? What about the prophecy that God's made that come to pass, which I'm not going to talk about this evening, but those do get talked about from these talks from time to time. We can surely trust those as well, I suggest. And therefore, archaeology is part of the mix that we can use to trust the Bible record. And therefore, it can strengthen our faith, it can make our belief stronger. And it can ensure that we believe that what God has said in the Bible, what God made happen, what happened, and what God left on record for us in the Bible record is indeed true. And therefore we can trust in God, in the other things that he has said. So I hope that's helpful, really, to give us a feel for the archaeology that's out there and how we can trust what we find, and how it links with the Bible.